Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, June 2nd. I'm your reader, Kelly Neff. Let's start out with a look at the weather. For today, there is a slight chance of storms with a southeasterly wind at 5 to 15 miles per hour. Today's high is expected to be 89, tonight's low 66. Tomorrow, partly sunny with an easterly wind at 5 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow's high 92 and the low 64. Sunday, partly sunny with an easterly wind at 5 to 15 miles per hour. The high should be 89 and the low 61. Come Monday, a slight chance of storms with an easterly wind at 5 to 15 miles per hour. The high Monday will be 88 and the low will be 61. Sunset tonight will be at 8:36. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 5:33. And today we will have 15 hours and 3 minutes of daylight. Today's top weather story is from meteorologist Jan Reihard. In this week's drought monitor released Thursday, drought conditions worsened for much of the state. A large portion of eastern Iowa is now classified as abnormally dry, with areas around Ottumwa, as well as up near Waterloo and Fayette, in moderate drought. Severe drought is present farther north. Keep in mind, while the drought monitor is released on Thursdays, it only accounts for rain through Tuesday morning. On average, June is typically our wettest month. We'll expect to receive over 5.5 inches of rain during the month, with May underperforming, ending nearly 2 inches below normal, and the year as a whole under as well, 3.76 inches in Cedar Rapids. Will you need some good soaking rains to make up the deficit? That's today's top weather story from meteorologist Jan Reihard. Our first front page story today is written by Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. Iowa relies on hotline to reduce litter. Turns out it's pretty hard to cite someone for highway littering, despite the fact food bags, pop cans, or even washing machines are left on the roadside. Iowa law has several code sections outlining charges for littering, but the Linn County Attorney's Office hasn't charged anyone in the past year. The Iowa State Patrol has filed 67 citations statewide, less than one for each of Iowa's 99 counties, and Cedar Rapids has cited fewer than 30 people in the last 15 months. Major Chad Colston of the Linn County Sheriff's Office said about littering, "We almost have to witness it. If we don't witness it and see the person who did it, it's very hard to prove. No deputies want to write a ticket that's not a good ticket." Colston said, "If a law enforcement officer is following behind a vehicle and sees trash fly out of the window, the officer can turn on the flashing lights, which allows the in-car camera to record what happened in the seconds before. But he says even that doesn't always work. He says, if it's a carload of kids, how do you know which person did it? Challenges with enforcement have made it even more important to discourage littering and encourage local cleanup. Keep Iowa Beautiful and the State Patrol run a hotline that allows motorists to report littering from other cars. The hotline received 67 complaint calls in 2022, but none from January 1st through May 15th, according to the State Patrol. The agency issued 40 warning letters in 2022. The letter tells the driver their car was linked to littering and provides the date and location of the reported offense. The letter states, randomly discarded trash, even the smallest item, such as a cigarette butt, endangers our environment, our wildlife, and may even threaten our safety. Picking up litter and debris costs taxpayers, like you, more than $13.5 million each year. Although warning letters don't result in charges, Keep Iowa Beautiful Director Andy France says he thinks they deter future littering. He says, if I got something from the highway patrol saying we have a report that you were doing this, I would think the majority of people would think twice about continuing to do that. Since January 1st of last year, Cedar Rapids police have cited 10 people for depositing litter on a highway, 13 for illegal dumping, and 3 for littering in parks or public spaces. The most common Iowa Code section used to cite someone for road litter is 321.369, which prohibits leaving trash, garbage, rubbish, litter, offal, or any other debris on the highway. It's a simple misdemeanor that comes with a $90 fine and court costs that bring it up to $158.50. Another code section is for commercial vehicles that spill litter. This type of ticket will cost you a $260 fine, with surcharges bringing it up to $350. Colston said, lots of times on the interstate or highways, you'll see the lighter weight stuff that comes out of a truck that's traveling down the road. Many area landfills try to address that by requiring drivers to have their loads secured. The Cedar Rapids and Linn County Solid Waste Agency fines residential and commercial customers $25 if waste isn't covered. More common than littering calls are calls about dumping of large amounts of garbage, appliances, or furniture on county or gravel roads. In those cases, deputies go out to the scene and sort through the garbage, trying to find identifying information, such as a piece of mail that has a name or address. If they find a name, they will reach out to the person and ask them to remove the waste. Colson says, we've had cases before where people say, yeah, I did it, and I'll clean it up. We've allowed them to clean it up. We won't send that to the public health department or county attorney for a civil fine. Because it's difficult to stop littering, many eastern Iowa communities have stepped up efforts to clean up the garbage. Cedar Rapids City Manager Jeff Pomerantz has a one-bag challenge that encourages every resident to clean up at least one bag of litter each year. So far, in fiscal 2023, which ends at the end of this month, more than 5,500 bags of litter have been collected by volunteers, contractors, and city staff through the program. Community groups also take responsibility for roadsides through the Adopt a Highway program, which is more than 1,000 groups each year. The Iowa Department of Transportation told the Gazette that last fall. Also on the front page today is a story written by Jamie Martin Trainer of the Gazette. Lyme disease defies easy diagnosis, long-term treatments. Dateline, Fairfax. Getting Lyme disease changed Courtney Hoffman's life. Before the diagnosis, Hoffman says she was happy with her life. She was a teacher, had a vibrant social life, was able to support her kids in their activities, and was active in her community. After starting to show symptoms in 2002, she began experiencing memory loss and chronic exhaustion. Hoffman of Fairfax described her diagnosis process as, quote, a litany of misdiagnoses, where doctors from across the United States tried and failed to find out what was causing her symptoms. With symptoms ranging from depression and anxiety to migraines and allergies, Hoffman said none of the treatments helped. Ultimately, Hoffman quit her job to see if lessening stress would help. It didn't. She said, I couldn't function. I couldn't be a good teacher, and I couldn't be a good mom. When a friend mentioned her symptoms sounded like Lyme disease, which is an illness transmitted by deer ticks, Hoffman brushed the idea aside, saying she never had the bullseye rash that often accompanies the tick bite. But after getting tested by a Lyme disease specialist in Missouri, her results from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention came back positive. Despite finally getting a diagnosis, Hoffman said she had to try several treatment plans in several states due to lack of specialists in Iowa before finally finding an option that worked in 2021. Hoffman said, it's been horrible. It's like the worst thing you can imagine because nobody knows what it is. They don't understand it, and they don't know how to help you. While treatment has allowed for her to regain some of her old life back, including spending time with her grandchildren and working as a respite care provider, there are still areas of her life that will forever be changed. Hoffman said she has to follow a strict diet, continue with lymphatic massages for her muscles, meet with a doctor in Waterloo every few months, and has bouts of low energy. She said, "I'm thankful for every single day I wake up. I never take anything for granted anymore." In 2021, the latest data released by the state showed 356 cases of Lyme disease reported in Iowa. That number has been increasing most years, according to the Iowa Public Health Tracking Portal. Because of the nature of Lyme disease, the infection is investigated at the state level, according to Jennifer Miller, the disease prevention specialist at Johnson County Public Health. It is considered an endemic in Iowa, meaning it occurs regularly in an area. Unreleased data from 2022, provided by Miller, shows 162 cases were reported, considerably below the 2021 total. So far this year, Miller said, 25 cases have been reported, but it's before the peak transmission season when people are outdoors. Miller said, "The kind of land that we have, it's conducive. That just does put us at a higher risk." Tina Rosenkranz is the deputy city clerk and treasurer for the city of Fairfax. She said she first became aware of Lyme disease and its accompanying problems through a friend, and she wanted to raise awareness. Rosenkranz said, "All of this really breaks your heart when you listen to it, how horrible this disease actually is. It doesn't get recognized enough." For the past several months, Rosenkranz and several volunteers have been planning a 5K race where participants can walk or run to raise money and awareness for Lyme disease. The 5K starts at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning at Fairfax City Hall. There is an alternate 1K route. Hoffman met Rosenkranz and is acting as the spokesgirl for this event. The 5K is raising money for an organization named Lyme Warrior, a nonprofit run by individuals with Lyme disease who advocate for education and support events across the United States. Lyme Warrior sent Rosenkranz the steps to help in organizing a 5K, as well as other resources to give out at the event. While the initial round of antibiotics to treat Lyme disease may be covered by insurance, long-term symptoms and subsequent treatments are not. Hoffman said the financial burden caused by Lyme disease was part of the reason it took so long to find a treatment plan that worked for her. With a limited money that could be budgeted for treatment, she had to do a lot of that research by herself. Sharon Ibanez, the Community Engagement and Events Director with Lyme Warrior, said treatment for Lyme disease can cost thousands of dollars every year. Ibanez said treatment for her and her two daughters annually costs around $15,000. Ibanez said, "I was searching for grants because treatment is very expensive and we earn a very limited income." Ibanez says Lyme Warrior looks to fight for patients to get better, more accessible treatment. While the various programs are costly, Ibanez said, finding a program that works for individuals can streamline that process and mitigate costs. She said, "Our goal is to help educate and create resources for other Lyme patients so that hopefully we can help cut their treatment journey to a much shorter time than ours has been. You can't force everybody to listen, but we're going to try." From the Iowa Today page, we have a story written by Vanessa Miller of the Gazette, UI Picks New Engineering Dean, Dateline, Iowa City. 6 months after launching a search to replace Harriet Nemhard as Dean of the College of Engineering, the University of Iowa yesterday announced Anne F. McKenna, a Vice Dean at Arizona State University, will take the reins of the 2,000-plus student college on August 16th. McKenna has been at Arizona State since 2010, serving in a range of roles from director of the Polytechnic School, interim vice dean for research and innovation, and chair of the Department of Engineering. She currently serves as vice dean of strategic advancement at the Ira A. Fulton Schools of Engineering and is an engineering professor in the Polytechnic School. As UI College of Engineering Dean, McKenna will make $375,000 annually. She'll succeed Nembhard, who, in December, was named president of the Harvey Mudd College in Claremont, California. Nembhard, earning $360,000 at UI, will start her new role July 1st, 3 years after joining the Iowa City campus. Between when she leaves June 30th and the time McKenna starts, Biomedical Engineering Department Executive Officer Joseph Reinhardt will serve as acting dean. In yesterday's hire announcement, McKenna says she's honored to serve. She said in a statement, "It is clear the University of Iowa is a special place that embodies a collaborative spirit and values working across disciplines to develop innovative and impactful solutions to complex technological challenges. I am thrilled to join such a talented and dedicated community to help advance and grow the College of Engineering." McKenna was one of three engineering dean finalists who were invited to visit UI in May. The other two were Robert Albertini, professor and head of the School of Civil Construction Engineering at Oregon State, who previously led two National University Transportation Research Centers, and Tillman Wolf, electrical and computer engineering professor, senior vice provost for academic affairs, and associate chancellor for space and capital planning at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College. McKenna earned both a bachelor's and master's degree in mechanical engineering from Drexel University in Philadelphia and a doctorate in engineering education from the University of Cal Berkeley. Before Arizona State, McKenna served as a program director at the National Science Foundation in Arlington, Virginia, and as education improvement director in the McCormick School of Engineering at Northwestern University, where she did postdoctoral research. McKenna's research has focused on entrepreneurial thinking in the context of engineering, faculty member mentorship, and curricular innovations, design teaching and learning, and inclusivity in higher education engineering structures, culture, and policies, according to the UI. Strengths of the college include high-caliber faculty, staff, and students, an attractive and functional new building, a dean angling to tackle major existing structural issues, and faculty and staff commitment to be part of the solution of the college's issues, she said. Those issues, according to the report, include lack of racial, ethnic, and gender diversity of the student body, faculty, and staff, limited laboratory and educational space for undergraduates, unclear communication of the college's value proposition being small but within a large research university, and limited financial resources, hindering the college's ability to scale up and leverage what it has. Regarding the college's enrollment, which has dropped at the undergraduate level from 5 years ago at 2588 to just 1764 last fall, engineering administrators have complex issues to address, according to McKenna, who says the UI's new budget model has an outsized impact on the college. Because the undergraduate population of the college is small and students get on average a higher level of scholarship financial aid than in other colleges, the college does not receive the total amount of money per pupil to cover the cost of educating them. The report notes that Nembhard was trying to drive a conversation with UI administration about making strategic investments to help the College of Engineering increase its net tuition revenue. The report noted, "An open question is how much the UI values its college engineering, comparing it with other research universities." It goes on to say, the college's market is one in which its competitors have higher rankings and more advanced facilities. They also have better marketing, including cool videos on their websites and personalized video that is sent to admitted students, as well as consistent, enthusiastic, and effective engagement by faculty, students, and alumni in recruiting students. Also on the Iowa Today page, Emily Anderson of the Gazette writes one about a backhoe crash and a downed power line in Iowa City. Dateline, Iowa City. The Iowa City Fire Department responded to a backhoe crash, house fire, and downed power line all at the corner of Fairchild and Lynn Streets Wednesday, according to a news release from the department. First responders were called at 1:14 p.m. In response to the backhoe crash, the backhoe was on Fairchild Street, which is closed, and part of a street reconstruction project. The call was quickly upgraded to a fire response at the house at 230 Fairchild Street as it caught fire. When firefighters arrived at 1:24 p.m., they found smoke coming from all sides of the house and a power pole with the transformer on the ground near the front yard of the home. One person was trapped in the backhoe with power lines draped over it. The fire was located in the attic and brought under control by 2:05 p.m. and extinguished by 2:41 p.m. A city spokesperson said the backhoe crash was part of a series of events which led to the fire, but the incident remains under investigation. The person in the backhoe was safely removed, and there were no occupants in the house. No civilians or firefighters were injured. On the top stories page, we have one written by Tom Barton of the Gazette about Ron DeSantis speaking in Cedar Rapids. Dateline, Cedar Rapids. In his first visit to Iowa as a declared presidential candidate, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis repeatedly framed Iowa and Florida as partners in a Republican battle to, quote, restore sanity, be that prohibiting instruction on gender identity and sexual orientation in public schools, or banning gender-affirming care for minors and abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy. DeSantis spoke to a crowd of 500 people Wednesday at Hawkeye Downs Speedway and Expo Center and said, Iowa has really set a great standard. He went on to say, people have said that all of the success in Iowa with these great conservative policies makes Iowa the Florida of the North. I don't know, maybe we're the Iowa of the South, he said to loud applause. He went on to say the elites of D.C. could learn a thing or two about what Iowa has done and the common sense and conservative values, but instead, President Biden and his crew are intent to plunge this country into the abyss. In his Cedar Rapids trip, he vowed to send Biden, quote, back to his basement, and said the nation is careening toward bankruptcy in the wake of Biden's debt ceiling deal with Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. He told the crowd that, quote, we will fight the woke mob and leave woke ideology in the dustbin of history where it belongs. DeSantis focused much of his speech on his ability to get results rather than just deliver rhetoric, drawing a thinly veiled comparison to former President Donald Trump, who, by far, remains the leading Republican frontrunner in the polls, both nationally and in Iowa. He said the GOP needs to dispense with the culture of losing as he seeks to weaken Trump's grip on the GOP. Iowa Democratic Party Chair Rita Hart, speaking with reporters, criticized new laws signed by DeSantis in Florida that heightened abortion restrictions and loosened gun ownership regulations. Hart assessed, while he focuses on culture wars, DeSantis has done nothing to address the biggest economic challenges that are facing families. She said DeSantis's conservative agenda would strip away Iowans' freedoms. As far as local reaction, Jade and Andrew Lammers of Cedar Rapids, who are both undecided Republicans, said they're looking for a candidate who supports a strict abortion ban and strengthening gun rights. The 22-year-old Jade Lammers said she doesn't know much about DeSantis's policies, but, quote, we knew He's been doing a good job as governor of Florida and wanted to hear him in person. I want a candidate who is very focused on the American middle class and allowing faith to be a part of the freedom that we enjoy here in America. She said, I would be okay with another Trump presidency. I think it would also be okay with DeSantis being president. 26-year-old Andrew Lambers, a forklift operator, said he's looking for a nominee who is less polarizing, with fewer character flaws than Trump. He said, I'm looking to hear what his plans are for replicating his success and policies in Florida across the whole United States. Donald Trump was also in Iowa, and after his first event Thursday morning before a suburban Des Moines conservative club, he spoke to the Gazette, saying the drama some Republican voters talk about is, in his view, precisely what makes him an effective candidate and president. However, many Republicans in Iowa, who will cast the first votes in the presidential primary early next year, say they are considering supporting someone other than Trump. Those Republicans often say that while they like the significant conservative accomplishments during Trump's 4 years in office, they do not like the drama that comes with Trump's sometimes abrasive speaking style or legal issues. If Trump wins the Republican presidential nomination, he said he would consider picking Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds as his running mate. Let's move on now to the Insight page, where we do have a Gazette editorial for today that says, Sensor Network Saved for Now. The Nutrient Research Center at Iowa State University has announced it intends to fund a network of water quality sensors monitoring water pollution on Iowa streams and rivers, despite a legislative effort to defund the sensor network. This is good news for Iowans who care about water quality and who believe access to data is needed to measure the state's efforts to reduce nitrate and phosphorus running into waterways. The Nutrient Research Center and its director, Matt Helmers, deserve credit for not allowing politics to spawn a chilling effect on water quality research. Helmers said in an email to the Gazette's Aaron Jordan, the Iowa Water Quality Information System is an important tool for monitoring water quality in the state and tracking the effectiveness of the Iowa Nutrient Reduction Strategy. The legislative vote to defund the network was a short-sighted political power play. The effort was led by Republican Senator Dan Zumbach of Ryan, whose son-in-law co-owns an 11,600-head cattle feedlot constructed in the Bloody Run Creek watershed in northeast Iowa. One of the sensors at issue is within sight of the feedlot on Bloody Run Creek, a trout stream designated by the Department of Natural Resources as one of Iowa's outstanding waters. Defunding the sensors amounts to a blatant move by Republicans who control the legislature to control the message about progress on cleaning up Iowa's dirty water. Data from the sensors has consistently shown that Iowa's voluntary approach for meeting goals set in the state's nutrient reduction strategy have failed to make significant progress. Still, even with Iowa State's commitment, funding for research using sensor data at the University of Iowa will be reduced. UI received $375,000 from the Nutrient Research Center to fund its analysis of the sensor data and was expected to boost to $500,000 next budget year. Instead, UI's participation will receive $290,000 next year and $250,000 the following year. So, even with Iowa State's laudable commitment, GOP lawmakers have managed to curtail research funding. Iowans are the losers. The sensor system is owned by the people of Iowa. The data collected is public information, and the resulting research gives us a clear picture of how little meaningful progress has been made in cleaning up our water. It's an issue too important to allow lawmakers motivated by their ties to large ag interests to keep Iowans in the dark. And that's today's Gazette editorial. We do have one community letter today. It's from Tamara Taylor Hillier of Cedar Rapids, who says, I am disgusted and extremely concerned about the direction our state government is going. Our governor just signed into law unnecessary measures that reduce and diminish rights, freedoms, and the worth of persons. Banning books and not allowing discussion of any topic is a formula for creating fear, shame, and increasing mental health problems in young people. That's the opposite of what education is all about. Education is about questioning and learning to be critical thinkers. This starts very young. There has to be some trust in parents and others who help them to make good judgments on what's age appropriate for kids to learn and when. This should not be legislated. It's interesting that the Republican Party used to be for limited government control, and now it is taking over many aspects of our lives. It's foolish to underestimate what younger children already know about and are exposed to from many sources. Our governor is moving us backward to suppression, government overreach, and extremism. This is reminiscent of dangerous trends in history that voters better pay attention to. Voters of Iowa, beware, and remember you have the power to move this state away from such extremely conservative views and actions that are reducing freedoms right and left. Do not let this go on, or we will surely regret it. That's according to Tamara Taylor Hillier of Cedar Rapids. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, June 2nd on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. First, we start with the shorter other notices from Monticello. Mary Ellen Squires, age 101, died Tuesday, May 30th. The Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Center Point is in charge of those arrangements. From Newhall, Linda May Meyer, age 71, died Wednesday, May 31st. Assisting the family will be the Phillips Funeral Home of Keystone. From Robbins, Deborah L. Christensen, age 70, died Wednesday, May 31st. The Cedar Memorial Funeral Home of Cedar Rapids will be in charge of those arrangements. And from Williamsburg, Florine Rowe, age 88, died Wednesday, May 31st. Assisting the family will be the Powell Funeral Home of Williamsburg. Now for the longer, more detailed announcements. Richard Kuhlbeck of Cedar Rapids passed away on May 29th. A celebration of life is being planned for June 16th at Cedar Hills Community Church at 1 p.m. Interment will be at the Concord Cemetery in Garner on July 22nd, where another celebration will also be held. Gifts and memorials may be made in Rich's honor to CR Network of Cedar Rapids. Vernon Doyle Naggetts, age 93, passed away peacefully in Naples, Florida on March 8th. A time of visitation for family and friends will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Saturday, June 3rd at Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Services in Iowa City. From Van Horn, Steve Schlau, S-C-H-A-L-L-A-U, age 70, died Wednesday, May 31st following a long battle with cancer. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 Monday morning, June 5th, at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church in Van Horn, with the Reverend Craig Steibel and the Reverend Jim Miller as concelebrants. Burial will follow in the Keystone Cemetery with graveside military rites. Visitation will be held from 2 to 6 p.m. Sunday at the church in Van Horn, and a memorial fund has been established. Irene Eleanor O'Connor, age 88, of Cedar Rapids, died Wednesday, May 31st, peacefully of natural causes. Visitation will be 1 to 3 p.m. Sunday, June 4th, at Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Cedar Rapids. Funeral Mass will be at 10:30 Monday morning, June 5th, at St. Pius X Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids with the Reverend John Sita. Burial will be in the Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Meals on Wheels. Those unable to attend are invited to watch the service via live stream. You can find the live stream link on Irene's tribute wall and share your support and memories with her family at www.stuartbaxter.com. Gary V. McMahon of Marengo, better known as Flying Man, age 74, died Sunday, May 28th at the Manchester Regional Medical Center. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 Saturday morning, June 3rd, at the First Presbyterian Church in Marengo, with the Reverend Annie Thorne and Pastor Cheryl Untide officiating. Burial will be in the Marengo Cemetery. The family will receive friends from 4 to 8 p.m. Friday, June 2nd at the First Presbyterian Church. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be contributed to Safe Haven of Iowa County. Kloster Funeral Home in Marengo is assisting the family with arrangements. Helen Elizabeth Phelan of Iowa City died May 30th at Briarwood Healthcare Center. A memorial mass will be celebrated at 10 o'clock Thursday morning, June 8th at St. Mary's Church. Family will greet friends for 1 hour prior to the service. According to her wishes, Helen's body has been donated to the University of Iowa Hospital's Deeded Body Program. Helen's family say they would like to express their gratitude to Dr. Butler, Dr. Eberle, and the entire staff at Briarwood Healthcare Center for the compassionate care she received these last 2 years. Memorial gifts in her name may be made to Mercy Hospital Foundation, St. Mary's Church, the University of Iowa Foundation, or Hampshire Auditorium, or the Museum of Art. Gary Wilbur Stephen Wilhelmy of Center Point passed on June 1st, surrounded by his family. Graveside services with military honors will be held at 11 o'clock Monday morning, June 5th, at the Urbana Memorial Cemetery. Arrangements by the Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Center Point. Arthur Raymond Crominga entered this world by way of Castle Grove Township west of Monticello in 1936. And passed away on May 30th at the age of 86, surrounded by much love. Funeral services will be held at 11 o'clock Saturday morning, June 3rd, at St. Matthew Lutheran Church in Monticello, with private interment at the Oakwood Cemetery. Pastor Dave Ramish will officiate. Visitation will be held from 9 o'clock until the time of service at the church. Ivan Keith Grimm, age 65 of Waterloo, passed away from a sudden illness. A celebration of life will be held from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. June 24th at the Shellsburg Mason Hall. Now let's move on to the sports page, where we find a story written by John Steppe of the Gazette. Getz named Iowa's interim AD. Dateline, Iowa City. The University of Iowa has tapped Beth Gates to serve as interim athletics director following Gary Barta's retirement August 1st. The UI made the announcement Thursday. Getz joined Iowa Athletics last year as deputy athletics director and has a wide range of experience in collegiate athletics, including as a former AD, coach, and athlete. UI President Barbara Wilson said in a news release, quote, "Beth is a talented and respected leader, not only at Iowa, but also at the national level in college athletics. I am grateful she has agreed to lead this crucial part of our university, and I'm confident she will generate a lot of excitement and forward momentum for our student athletes, coaches, athletic staff, and Hawkeye fans," end quote. A national search for a permanent AD is planned for early next year, according to the news release, especially giving Getz a 5-plus-month trial run in the new position before considering outside candidates. This will not be Getz's first time as an interim athletics director. When Minnesota fired Norwood Teague amid sexual harassment allegations in 2015, she stepped up as interim AD for the 2015-16 season. She also was permanent AD at Ball State from 2018 to 22 and had high-level roles in UConn, Minnesota, and Butler's department since 2008. Getz was the vice chair of the NCAA Division I Women's Basketball Committee in 2021-22 and was on the NCAA Competition Oversight Committee in 2018. The 48-year-old administrator has quickly gained respect in her first year on Elliott Drive as the number two person in the department behind Barta. Head men's wrestling coach Tom Brand said last month, she is a straight shooter. You could tell the genuineness, trust, right away. Barta's replacement date of August 1st is exactly 17 years after his official start date of August 1st, 2006. The soon-to-be-departing AD said in the statement last week, the decision did not come without significant thought, discussion, and prayer. His contract had been set to expire in June of next year. Kentz's promotion is subject to approval by the Board of Regents. Her base salary will increase from $310,000 to $650,000 when she takes on the new role in August. That's according to her contract obtained by the Gazette via a public records request. Kentz said in the news release, the Hawkeyes have a proud and storied tradition with the greatest fan base in the country, and I am appreciative of the opportunity to lead the department. I'm committed to supporting our talented coaches, staff, and student-athletes as we build on the positive trajectory of athletic and academic excellence. Also on the sports page is a story written by Nathan Ford about the Boys State Soccer Tournament. A traditional power was back at the Boys State Tournament after a rare year off in a position for a ninth Saturday championship game. Our recent arrival was not willing to vacate its spot. Fourth-ranked Western Christian tied the score with 4:30 remaining against number 2-ranked Iowa City Regina, then outlasted the Regals 9-8 in a 10-round penalty shootout to advance to the Class 1A title game for the third consecutive year. Western Christian goalkeeper J.D. Pettit said minutes after stopping a PK that sealed the semifinal win, "We're really resilient. Regina coach Rick LaRue, who had otherwise just about seen it all in 15 state tournaments, said, I've never gone this long in a shootout. For a time Thursday, it seemed like the Regals would get a chance to continue improving on their 8-for-8 mark in state championship game appearances. Jack Hoover worked a precise give-and-go with Laird Holden and scored off the post with 22 minutes left in the first half, his third goal of the tournament. Pettit said, I would say they're definitely the best team we've played this season. They're very possessive, which is something we haven't always been. Good chances don't come often on either side, but Western continued pushing. In the 75th minute, defender Aiden Awinga heard the call from the sideline to push up for a corner kick. Miles Bacon floated the ball to the back post, where Awinga was sprinting to head in the leveler. He said, I knew I could jump pretty high, so I was like, I've got to do this. We had to work hard anyway. It's going to come right now. 2 10-minute overtime periods settled nothing. Despite Davenport Assumption's claiming last year's 1A title in a shootout, Western Christian remained confident. Owinga said, we're just thinking we've been here before. Take a deep breath and bury it. Pettit made a save to cancel out an initial Wolfpack miss. Regina's Dylan Vitito then got a hand to Owinga's and three other Wolfpack attempts, and the ball crept over the line each time. LaRue said, so close, right? So close. Western Christian will again seek its first state title Saturday at 10 o'clock against top-ranked Grundy Center Gladbrook Rhinebeck, itself a semifinal shootout winner over Des Moines Christian. The bigger schools also played yesterday, and here's a story written by Nathan Ford of the Gazette about West High of Iowa City. It was naturally a bit of a slow start, though you'd never know it watching Iowa City West's starting forwards now. Michael Nelson scored 30 goals for the Trojans last season, but an off-season knee injury meant he didn't start 2023 at full strength. Caleb Wendy joined West this season after totaling 31 goals in 2 years at Regina. Then Wednesday night at County Soccer Park, they started together at the top of West formation and both found the net to help the 6th-ranked Trojans top number 10 Cedar Rapids Kennedy 2-0 in a Class 4A state quarterfinal game. All four of the championship matches will be held on Saturday. The girls' state tournament continues today in all three classes, but the Gazette area has no teams represented. The girls' high school softball rankings are out for this week. In Class 5A, West Des Moines Valley sits on top. Linmar is ranked number 4. and Cedar Rapids Kennedy is ranked 13th. In Class 4A, the state leader is Dallas Center Grimes, with Cedar Rapids Xavier number 4 in the state. In Class 3A, Williamsburg sits on top of the state, with Mount Vernon number 7, Solon number 8, Center Point Urbana number 10, and Benton Community number 15. Iowa City Regina is number 1 in Class 2A, with Lisbon ranked 3rd, Wilton number 4 in the state, Albernett number 12. In Class 1A, the number 1 ranked team is Southeast Warren. North Lynn is ranked number 4. Sigourney is 5th in the state in Class 1A. Also in sports, the Boys State Tennis Tournament is going on, a story filed by J.R. Ogden of the Gazette. Apparently, number 2 was number 1 for a pair of Mississippi Valley Conference boys tennis teams yesterday. Cedar Rapids Xavier, seeded 2nd in the Class 1A state team tournament, down number 1 Pella 5-1 in the championship match in Iowa City. At West Des Moines, number 2 Iowa City West dispatched of the top-seeded host, Waukee Northwest 5-2 in the Class 2A tournament. It was the fourth straight 1A title for the Saints, who started this season as a big unknown after losing 4 of its top 6 players. Xavier coach Jim Potts said, "I think we shocked some people." Although he said it was kind of a surprise to me, Potts said he and his assistant were not among the shocked. He said, "I kind of had a gut feeling that we could get it done in the singles," adding with a laugh that, quote, "we may have been the only ones." West won its second straight 2A title, beating a team that dominated the Trojans 8-1 early in the season. Coach Marshall Moeller said it was incredible, noting that the earlier loss was demoralizing. He said, "It was all of us coming together. It was all of us believing." The Saints opened the 2-day tournament Wednesday with a 5-2 win over Glenwood in the quarterfinals, then took down Decorah 5-0 in the semifinals. Decorah lost to Dubuque Walden 5-3 in the third-place match. Xavier now has won team titles in 2019, 21, 22, and 23. The 2020 tournament was wiped out by COVID. Potts said, "This one was pretty meaningful. It was really a good year for us." He said, Potts said, "was a strong favorite all year, and rightfully so." He said, "We did play well. We had to play well to beat them." Iowa City West opened the 2A tournament Wednesday with a 5-0 win over MVC rival Cedar Falls in the quarterfinals, then knocked off Pleasant Valley 5-0 to earn a spot in the finals for the 12th year in a row. Once there, it was all West again. The Trojans owned 11 state team titles, including 3 out of the last 4, and Moeller said everybody stepped up. Everybody. The matches were set for Waukee Northwest, but were moved inside to the Genesis Health Club in Des Moines by thunderstorms. "He had a really big talk with the team about the West High School tennis family," said Potts. And then Moeller said it really came down to everybody just uplifting everybody else. Pleasant Valley beat Linmar 5-3 in the third place bout. And in a baseball note, Jeff Johnson of the Gazette reports that the D3 World Series is returning to Cedar Rapids. The 8-team event begins today at Veterans Memorial Stadium. Jeff writes, "The NCAA Division III College World Series begins today at Veterans Memorial Stadium, home of the Colonels. The 8-team event is double elimination." Taking a look at what the season was for the participants, Johns Hopkins comes in with a record of 44-5. Salisbury is at 35-6. Lynchburg is at 43-7. Endicott is 45-7. Baldwin Wallace is 36-10. Wisconsin La Crosse is 36-11. East Texas Baptist is 40-13. Misericordia is 39-13. Games will be held at 1 o'clock and 7 o'clock today, noon and 6 Saturday, and noon and 6 on Sunday. In softball, locally, the NCAA Division III World Series is being played at Marshall, Texas, and yesterday, Coe College beat Linfield 3-0. On the sports page, on the sideline edition, the Iowa Letter Winners Club will induct its 34th Hall of Fame class on September 1st. It will include basketball standouts B.J. Armstrong and Gillette Law and wrestler Brent Metcalf. The class also includes football standout Eric Steinbach, Charlie Freddy of field hockey, Terry McFarland in softball, Peaches Roach Findlay in women's track and field, Bill Seberg in men's basketball, J. Daniel Sherman in wrestling, and Ann West Burmeyer in rowing. The induction ceremony will be held at the Feller Club Room at Carver Hawkeye Arena. Doors will open at 5 p.m. Meanwhile, Angelo Ferrari of Melissa, Texas High School announced Wednesday night he'll join the Iowa wrestling program. He had had offers from Virginia Tech and Rutgers and is projected to wrestle at 174 or 184. And another sideline report, Iowa senior Caitlin Clark will play in the John Deere Classic Pro-Am Golf Tournament on July 5th in a group with fellow Iowa native Zach Johnson. After her round, Clark will participate in the tournament's popular annual youth clinic. Here's a state news story that has local implications, written by Aaron Murphy of the Gazette. Low-income Iowans receiving health care and food assistance from government programs face additional eligibility and verification requirements with legislation signed into law Thursday by Governor Kim Reynolds. The new requirements apply to the food assistance program known as SNAP, the low-income health care program Medicaid, the children's health care program known as CHIP, and the family investment program, which provides cash assistance to needy families. The new state law disqualifies from food assistance any Iowans who have assets totaling more than $15,000 or a second vehicle worth more than $10,000 or an income of more than 160% of the federal poverty level. That income threshold equates to $23,328 for an individual or $39,776 for a family of three. The new law also requires all public assistance recipients to complete a computerized identity verification questionnaire and requires SNAP and Medicaid recipients to cooperate with Child Support Services regarding child support payments. Supporters have said the changes ensure only those Iowans who are truly in need of government assistance are the ones benefiting from the programs. Iowa Senate President Amy Sinclair, a Republican of Allerton, said on a recent episode of Iowa Press on PBS, "I think every Iowan would agree we shouldn't have fraud, waste, or abuse in a system that is designed to help the neediest among us." Sinclair said, "We have seniors on fixed incomes. We ought to help them and make sure and verify them and get them on the road to being stable in their homes. We want to make sure our kids are fed, but we also want to make sure that we aren't using the limited assets we have as a state for folks who don't necessarily need them." Medicaid and SNAP fraud are exceptionally rare. 195 out of 278,000 SNAP recipients were disqualified for fraud during the 2022 state budget year, according to a state report. There were 235 open fraud cases in the state's Medicaid program, which has more than 886,000 people enrolled. Medicaid and SNAP are funded by the federal government. Medicaid is administered by the state. Iowa has hired private companies to manage the state's program, and SNAP is administered jointly by the state and federal governments. The provisions in the new law will require the addition of more than 200 new state government workers in the State Department of Health and Human Services. It will cost the state $7.5 million in the first 2 years to implement the new measures and ultimately result in a net reduction in state spending of just over $8 million in the 2027 state budget year. On the Business 380 page, we have a story written by members of the Gazette. American begins direct flights to D.C. Dateline, Cedar Rapids. The first American Airlines direct flight to Reagan National Airport in Washington, D.C. left the Cedar Rapids Airport Thursday morning. Marty Lenz is the director of the Eastern Iowa Airport and said, "This is the culmination of work that started years ago. In the past 5 years, we have stepped up those efforts to bring D.C. service here, and we are happy American Airlines was willing to invest in Eastern Iowa." Initially, the one daily flight will leave Cedar Rapids at 10:40 a.m., arriving in Washington just before 2 p.m. Then the return flight will leave D.C. at 8:30 a.m., arriving in Cedar Rapids at 10:05 a.m. American Airlines is using an aircraft with 76 seats, and Thursday's first flight out of Cedar Rapids was full. The flight to Cedar Rapids had almost 60 people, according to an airport news release. A second flight will be added September 6th. It'll leave Cedar Rapids at 6:20 in the morning, arriving at 9:35 in Washington, then depart at 8:05 p.m., arriving in Cedar Rapids at 9:44. Lentz said it is important to get the word out now about this second flight to show the popularity of a direct flight to the nation's capital with direct connections to other popular destinations. Lenz said, Americans' winter schedule is not yet finalized, so Eastern Iowa needs to show American how important and popular the DCA nonstop is, so the second departure will remain in schedule. The Cedar Rapids Airport has 17 nonstop destinations on 5 airlines. It's the largest airport within a 90-minute drive for 38% of Iowa's populations. Julie Rath, the Senior Vice President of Airport Operations for American Airlines, says American is the largest airline at Reagan Airport with 247 daily flights. And that concludes today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, June 2nd. I'm your reader, Kelly Neff. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thank you for listening.